Hello, everyone. Unfortunately, today is a bit of a sad day at Chaos Group. We found out that yesterday, unfortunately, one of the great members of the Chaos Group team, Yaroslav Krivanek, who was one of the original founders of the Corona team and part of the person, one of the people that starting the R&D group in our Chaos Check office, has passed away. And really, we're all a bit in shock and trying to process this information. He was a really great guy. He's been on the podcast a few times. And in fact, instead of posting the normal podcast I was going to post this week, we decided that I was going to repost an old podcast that we did with him back during Total Chaos 2018. I did a one with Yaroslav and Andra. And I think you will notice how Yaroslav is not only extremely knowledgeable about computer graphics, but is also very passionate about it as well. He will truly be missed, and we'd like to send our condolences to his family.
So is there some schedule exact time when we should start? Or how?
We've already started.
Seriously?
Yeah. Okay. We have already started. This is the most casual podcast you'll ever be. All right. It's like we happen to have a conversation. Oh, this is my business cards. I keep them in here.
Cool.
Yeah.
Nice.
Looks kind of cool. Mm-hmm. My wife gave that to me when I got my job at Chaos Group. She goes, you're going to need more business cards. Yeah, we already started. It's just like having a conversation. And then it's like, you know, people just happen to have microphones and they can overhear. Uh-huh. It's much more casual, as you can see. But the problem I have with my podcasting at this event, even though it's great, is that I'm having so many of them that I don't get to go to any talks.
Yeah.
So that means I haven't been able to see your talks. And that's an opportunity for you guys to talk a little bit about that. But I think the last time I talked to you, Andre, was at the D2 last year.
It was the D2 in Vienna.
When we made the announcements of our coexistence together, which is kind of awesome. And I think a lot of people had questions about, you know, your thoughts about how that has been over the last year and how the collaboration has worked a little bit. What can you say about that? Or yeah, you can say that too.
That's a good and hard question to start with.
Yeah.
So, you know, in just in the sheer amount of work, it's just nothing changed. There was so much work to do that I wanted to do and didn't have any time before.
Right.
And the same is true right now.
Okay.
It's just there's new opportunities.
Okay.
So we in the beginning, we had some like ideas like, okay, so the first day we have access to the source code repositories of the second side. Mm-hmm. I will take this and this and put it into Corona.
Right.
And then, you know, then you go to the conference and you do the announcement and you drink many beers. And mm-hmm. in the morning you go back to the office. Mm-hmm. And then you realize, you know, there's so much other stuff that was already planned. Mm-hmm. And what we basically did was that we just added extra stuff into the roadmap. Mm-hmm. And of course, it was not as simple as we thought. So in the end, it turned out that the first plans were super optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, what worked the best was just brainstorming. Just right. being able to sit with the Chaos Group guys, with Vlado, Blago, Asen, and others, and just mm-hmm. like one would start with... we have problem with rendering this stuff like caustics or mm-hmm. or the fakes that Vlado showed in the presentation.
Mm-hmm.
And we would just like try to solve it. And this is what really helped us
right.
so far.
Well, that's kind of awesome to have, you know, direct access to people that, you know, were both competitors and you admire. But now you can just, you guys working together, right? That's
a big difference. It's awesome. Also, it's difficult, you know, because previously you were doing presentation that somehow compared to products that
mm-hmm.
you can't make some comparisons mm-hmm. at this time. But yeah, this was what I was looking forward to, just seeing how some of the stuff that we were never able to do
mm-hmm.
was being done in V-Ray.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, it was like a matter of my professional prestige to put something into V-Ray to make V-Ray better.
So what have you been able to contribute back at this point? I know there's a lot of knowledge, and it's not, like you said, it's not as simple as like, I'll just take this code and it plugs right in here. It doesn't work that way, right?
Actually, this happened once in Corona, which was the DMC, which was the big thing that made everything two times faster.
Wow. Okay.
And for V-Ray people, I think our way, we have a very specific way we sample geometry lights.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about this is that it's smart, mm-hmm. but it's not the smartest technology on the market.
Okay.
But it's super simple. And super simple means it can be put into GPU renderer. So
it can be put into what?
GPU renderer.
Oh.
So I think I saw the tests and they were done like 1 week after we gave it to them.
Right.
About having better way to sample geometry lights, like triangles that emit light.
Okay.
With some trick that we do.
Right.
And we have this huge thing which we wrote a research paper on actually.
Mm-hmm.
We submitted it to SIGGRAPH and it got rejected.
Oh.
It was, you know, it's always SIGGRAPH has 20% success rate. So,
right, of course.
So when you get rejected, it's no biggie. It's mm-hmm. like, okay, this is not failed.
They have other things they want to talk about.
It just means that you will make it better and you will try next time.
Right.
And half of the reviewers thought it was too practical. The other half thought it was too theoretical.
Okay.
So we will have to make the message more clear, but... Basically, we have some like simple trick to make the rendering faster,
uh-huh.
and we are still waiting for V-Ray to put it in. But it has to do a lot of testing to use this. You would have to do a lot of testing, and it didn't happen yet. So
okay,
so we are still waiting for V-Ray how well it will work in V-Ray because it works well in
kind of awesome though if you think about it. You know, just from someone who's not necessarily a programmer but knows a lot about renderers, is that you were able to take some information. You guys are not necessarily a GPU renderer, you're a CPU renderer, but you had some practical code out there that could help the GPU renderer as well. So that's kind of awesome.
Yeah, it's more than a code, it's the idea, really.
It's the idea.
You really exchange ideas much more than pieces of code because, I mean, things are really intertwined into in a renderer, and
right.
then for that reason, you cannot just like take a piece of code from one renderer and put it into another one.
Right.
Except some of the cases like the DMC sampler, but you can really exchange the ideas, and based on the ideas that you get from the other guys, you can shape the renderer, and that's
right.
That's something that we have been really doing quite a lot. Over this last year, also Vlad was brave enough to actually sit down, get the code of Corona, and actually hack their adaptive lights into our code of Corona,
okay.
and start comparing the light solver that we have with the light solver that they have,
mm-hmm.
To get some results out of it, And again, he will probably not be taking the full code of the light solver that we have, but he will just pick out some of the ideas
mm-hmm.
that he saw there and that they didn't think about, that
right.
they think of, and just put it there. So we have some, you know, using some control variants, it's called.
Right.
It's all in the SIGGRAPH paper. That has been accepted. We had two submissions from
Corona. Oh, so you did get one accepted too.
Yeah, we had two submissions this year from Corona, from work that we have done that was really coming out of Corona.
Mm-hmm.
So one was the big the light solver that I have talked about it a little bit in my presentation here.
Okay.
And that has actually been accepted at SIGGRAPH. And
what can you tell me about the light solver?
What can I tell you about the light solver?
Start with the big picture that's understandable to the common person,
sure,
then we
sure,
can
sure.
get into our details.
Yeah. So, light solver. Okay, so suppose you have a scene that
yep.
has lots of lights.
Yes.
And you want to compute illumination from all of these lights, okay, at some given point in the scene.
Let's say there's 1,000 lights.
There's 1,000 lights.
Nothing.
Yeah,
yeah, no,
or 1,000 lights or 10,000 lights, and, you know, then there's sky and then there's the sun.
Yeah.
And then your poor ray tracer is computing illumination, working through all the different locations in the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And each of these locations, it just needs to know how much light there is, how much light is reaching that point from all of these lights.
Right.
And it cannot really, like, at some point, you cannot really enumerate all of these slides one after another, because there's so many of them that if you did it, you would never get the image out.
Right.
So you start sampling at random. And you have to be smart about how you do this sampling at random. You just randomly pick one of these slides. And you have to be smart about it, because if you don't do it in a smart way, you will introduce so much noise in right. in the image that, again, the render will never finish. So the light solver is really about being smart about how you pick these lights, okay? And the way we do it is that as we render the scene, we observe what various lights have contributed to various points in the scene, and we put it into some pretty cool formulas from machine learning. So that's why the name of the paper is Bayesian Online Regression for Direct Lighting Computation or something like that.
It sounds such an amazing SIGGRAPH title.
Exactly.
They are all like this. You know?
When Adam saw the title, he said, like, why don't you just name it so that it sounds like something that people can actually understand? And I was like,
That's not how SIGGRAPH papers are written.
Exactly. I'm catering to my market. I want to publish my paper. It has to sound really scientific. You know, that's what I'm doing here.
Yeah.
So, but it's actually very cool, because, I mean, this is, at the end of the day, what you do is some kind of adaptive sampling. But I've been thinking about adaptive sampling for quite some time. And what always bothered me with adaptive sampling is that you can, if you make a wrong decision early on when you haven't, you know, like the idea of adaptive sampling is seeing what, taking the information that you have seen so far, in this case, how much light contributes each single light source to different locations in the scene, and then making some further decisions based on that.
Right.
And if you make an error early on, it can completely digress into computing something totally inaccurate.
Irrelevant.
Yeah.
Right.
And so I've been thinking about this, and this has been a problem in adaptive sampling for years in general Monte Carlo simulations. And I've been thinking about it, how to solve this problem. And so I have been reading about machine learning, statistical learning, and when you actually, they have exactly the same kind of problem: unreliable information. You have a self-driving car, you get some sensor data, and they're not reliable. You cannot rely on it, and you still need to get something out, something that's going to work.
Right.
So I've been looking into the various mathematical frameworks that they use to deal with this problem of unreliable data. And one of them is this whole idea of Bayesian learning and Bayesian regression. Mm-hmm. And we have been able to kind of match these two things together. So so we have found out that this is an extremely good way of formulating the problem, and it helped us develop something that works reliably. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you get a really good speed up as you progress in the rendering.
Now, this is okay. Now, you've set it up perfectly for me to say this is about why bias rendering is better than unbiased rendering.
Well,
the thing I've always hated about the term unbiased rendering is the fact that it sounds like it's better because it's unbiased, and bias sounds worse.
Okay, well, I think we're more talking about my bad English pronunciation than about any science here, because I wasn't talking about
bias,
right? Yes. I wasn't talking about that. I was talking about, what was I talking
about?
But
your machine learning is making an adaptive choice.
It's making an adaptive choice.
Right. So if it's making a choice, it's not unbiased. It's biased towards that choice. No?
Okay. So we're really playing with words. Yes, yeah. It's biased toward the choice.
Yes.
In such a way that the rendered image is unbiased in the end. And while doing that, it's using Bayesian statistics.
Okay.
So that was the word that I actually used.
Okay.
So there's really, I think I did manage to make it really confusing?
Yes,
well,
I
did, right? I'm still confused. I know the
math, so, and I know I did the paper, right? So when you were talking about this, I initially imagined.
I'm not trying to start any argument. I'm actually trying to talk about semantics, and because this is an important subject.
No. The bottom line is that the algorithm is unbiased, and it's very powerful. So
no, but you still make. Are you making some the choices?
The choices you make them in an adaptive way. But you can formulate the whole computation in such a way that you don't introduce bias into the algorithm in the sense that the images that come out of the computation would be different than the ones that you would get without this technique. Okay, so you bias the choices,
right,
but the image that you get out at the end of the day is still the same. And that's the beauty of.
But isn't that the same in a lot of ways? Like you can turn the even in V-Ray, for example, which is more biased, right?
Biased.
Right?
Not Bayesian or
no, but biased, right? It's making choices.
Well, it's about the setting. So
you can turn
V-Ray and Corona is not one is not more biased than the other, like in principle.
Right.
It's just that. The defaults or the typical values that people use are probably more closer to unbiased solution in Corona. And even that might not be true for the latest version because there was huge improvements.
I don't know what you just said, but I think we're getting into this most difficult discussion.
We need a linguist.
What biased really means in terms of rendering, right?
There is, and this is a big argument, right? Because I'm telling not from the programming point of view, because I think this is a very valid argument to use in programming, but from the marketing point of view, people use the term unbiased as a means of saying that the other one is biased, because biased, semantically speaking, sounds wrong. Sounds like you're missing out on some information. But the fact is, when you're using machine learning or you're using adaptive lights or adaptive sampling of any kind of things, you're adapting the way that you're sampling thing based on information you've learned from this process, right? And you don't want to make the wrong choices, which is a very good argument for why it's like, well, I don't make the wrong choices because I'm an unbiased engine because I always choose everything. So there is something about adaptivity and about machine learning now that all of this is, even the denoisers are biased, right? Because they're biased towards what they've seen.
Okay, so, So, let me just comment on this. Okay, so the whole actually selling point of the light solver and of what we have done there is to make it adaptive in such a way that the final result is unbiased in the sense that the image that comes out of the renderer is exactly the same that the one you would get without using that technique,
right?
But you get it faster, okay?
Right, and in but you the, don't you don't waste rays,
and you don't waste rays,
right?
You don't waste rays because you.
But isn't a true unbiased renderer? Don't you waste a lot of rays because you just want to make sure you don't miss anything?
Yeah, you do.
Okay, exactly. So you're not wasting rays, right?
You're essentially what you're making sure here is that you waste less rays, and you're making your sampling decisions in a more intelligent way.
Yeah.
But it doesn't affect the biasedness or unbiasedness of your final image.
Right, because the shooting a ray on a computer, the cycle that it takes to shoot that ray is the same, no matter how many rays you shoot. So if you shoot way more rays than you need to, it doesn't matter how fast your ray tracer is, you're still going to take longer to get there in some ways.
Yeah. Well, there's a slight trade-off. Like when you do something super advanced, usually it means that the brute force, like the number of rays you need to shoot. You decrease the number of rays you need, but also each one of them can take way longer to produce.
Okay.
So when you are doing a new method in research or in production, you are not racing against, you know, not doing the decision. Uh-huh. When you do 5% improvement in the noise, it's usually worse because you also do like 20% slower raw performance.
Okay.
So you are racing against something like you need to make it at least twice lower noise.
Right.
Because you will also reduce the amount of raw
power you have, because you will be doing extra processing of some caching or some learning.
Yeah, well, that's one thing. And second thing is that when you put more intelligence into the algorithm, so one thing is, of course,
right,
the overhead of including that intelligence.
Exactly.
And second thing that also actually decreases the raw performance is that now the rays that you end up deciding to actually shoot are the ones that will, in fact, not be wasted. And so you will actually end up doing some shading work for them, while before, you know, many of these rays, you just shut them just in case, and they were just...
They hit nothing.
They hit nothing.
Right.
You don't do anything for them. So then actually the throughput in terms of the rays per second with these more intelligent algorithms, it's usually much decreased. But
it's decreased because they're actually doing something.
Because you make sure that you will only shoot the ones...
They're productive.
That will actually do something. Yeah.
Awesome. This is great. Now, the other thing, and I think this is also true, is a lot of people interpret unbiased as less settings, right? Which I think that's fine. I don't mind that necessarily. It's not necessarily true, but it's, you guys have, Corona has always been, seems to be very focused on the simple interface. The render itself is going to make most of the decisions for you, where you don't have to necessarily think about things. That what you just described as your new light solver is actually seems to be doing that for you in some ways, right?
Yeah.
So what that has been, from the user's point of view, do you think that's one of the biggest reasons for the success of Corona, that people can just use it without necessarily having to consider all these things?
Yes, definitely. This is the thing that was a new concept when we first did Corona and when people first started using it. So it wasn't faster than V-Ray because it wasn't optimized so much yet.
Right.
But it's just when you need to do like 10 preview images and you need to tweak some settings, then what actually matters is not the render time. It's just also the time that you spend setting everything up.
Right. It renders fast, but you rendered it 10 times.
And this time is actually even more valuable because you need to do it yourself, but you can have 10 computers in your basement that do the rendering for you.
Right.
If you would keep 10 people in your basement, that would probably be illegal.
Right.
So this is what people realize, is that Even if it's not as fast, for example, for animations, you couldn't do like 2 minute per frame animations in Corona.
Right.
That was always faster in V-Ray, at least in the beginning. But just when you take into account the sheer amount of time you need to spend optimizing the scene, then in the end, it's the same.
It's interesting because I've thought about this for a while. I used to work in visual effects, as you know, and you were at Sony, right, for a little bit. Or
I was working on Arnold when it was still under Sony.
Right.
I was with Weta for a short period of time.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, but it was really as a part of my kind of like academic career.
Sure.
We had some results, so we went over to work with the guys in the studio to implement some of our technology into their products.
Okay. Because even in the early days, when I was working and we were still using the old version of RenderMan, you know, when it was still the Rays render and it was a scanline or rasterized rendering, the way that you would think about hiring lighters, right, which is, as you say, Andre, is the biggest cost, is the cost of the artist is much more expensive than buying computers, right? But you basically see how many shots are we doing, right? And then you would divide, you would say, take that by 25, and you'd say, that's how many lighters you need. So 25 shots per lighter was sort of a good ballpark estimate as how many lighters you need. And that could be, that means that one artist over the course of a year would only light 25 shots, because that's how much work it would take to get the lighting to RADS, because you didn't have GI back then. You had to fake everything. Yes. You had to do all these different tricks to make it look photoreal. Now, it would look photoreal in the end, but it took a lot more
effort. And I know that this has been a real big argument when this whole GI technology has been adopted.
And ray tracing specifically.
Path tracing.
Yeah.
And I really wondered if, you know, this promise of reducing the LiDAR time, if it's been actually delivered. You know, like, do you know what the ratio would be today? Or
if you did it on rasterized rendering?
Well, how, you know, I mean, how many lighting artists you need today versus how many you needed back in the day? It is?
I can do 150 shots with an LiDAR.
Yeah?
Yeah, okay. Easily. Okay. Easily.
So it works.
It works.
So the next, I think, like, the next job to kind of reduce is... what is it called? A rotoscoping artist.
Roto artist.
Yeah, roto artist. I think like with the...
No, the roto artist has been solved. It goes to India.
Yeah. Well, it either goes to India, but the next step is it goes to a deep learning algorithm.
That is another one. But and that's possible as well. Rotoscoping artist is a tough artist. And it's like, you know, it's not always very fun. Rotoscoping.
Yeah, well, exactly.
The rotoscoping always started. What rotoscoping was good was a good training mechanism for people that wanted to get into paint and comp and stuff like that, right? Mm-hmm. And so that was always a great thing that was going on. So, but yeah, I think this idea of lighting, and the fact is, ray tracing is the only way you're going to get more physically based materials and lighting, etc. So I think this is really important. And people are still, let's just put it this way. When you get something into a real-time engine, if you're going to use the current real-time rendering technology, which is rasterized rendering, it takes more effort for it to look as photoreal, even though it will render in real time, right? There's certain efforts that needs to take place as opposed to just ray tracing it. Okay, this is fascinating. I think I'm very excited about you guys going to SIGGRAPH, so I'll see you guys there. Your talk.
I had a little story to contribute on the on the topic of collaboration between Corona and V-Ray, because this was a situation which I wasn't sure how to deal with it. Actually, early last year. So a bit more than a year ago, I was approached by one of the employees of V-Ray, Asen Atanasov.
Asen.
And he's a great guy. And, he presented, they had a small paper at SIGGRAPH before, and he got excited and he decided to get into a PhD. And he writes me this email.
He was the one on the flake stuff, right?
Yeah. That was the one.
Stochastic flakes.
Yeah, stochastic flakes.
Mm-hmm.
And so he decided that he would like to actually continue this track and do more research and get a PhD. So he wrote me an email. I would like to sign up for a PhD with you. You know, a guy from a company that's officially a competition.
Right.
And you'll start thinking...
And this is before you guys merged, right?
Well, this is before we merged, but it was already... I mean, the talks about the merger were already underway. But officially...
But he may not have known about it.
Yeah. I mean, he wasn't supposed to know about it.
Of course not.
No one was supposed to know about it.
And I didn't know about
it. I really was wondering what was going on. Like, if... You know, and how do I deal with it? You know, like, do I tell him... Because, like, if the companies were really competition, I would feel really that this is, you know, a serious conflict of interest to be a PhD advisor of someone who's an employee of a competition.
Right.
So I would have to say no. But at the same time, I knew that, you know, the merger was going to happen. So that was fun. So I played this game of, okay, yeah, we can do this somehow. We will work on something that is kind of neutral that can be used by both companies. And eventually, of course, the information about the merger came out. So right now he's officially enrolled into a PhD at Charles University. So I'm officially his advisor.
Right.
So we have been working together on the write-up that they have for SIGGRAPH about the adaptive dome lights. So this is something that we wrote up together.
Right.
So, I mean, they did all the technology, but I was there to kind of help out with the writing, because this is what I've been doing for the last 15 years.
Okay.
And we're planning some more work, especially on BRDFs, complex BRDFs, some follow-up on the work with the microflakes.
Mm-hmm.
So we would like to do some more work on this so that you're able to actually combine, do layered algorithms with the flakes, which is something that you cannot do right now. And for that, you need to figure out transparency of these flakes. So you mm-hmm. have to give them some notion of a size and so on. So we want to work on that. And then we want to extend this to scratches, procedural scratches, because that's what people have been asking for some
right.
time.
Right. Yeah. Yes. I would love procedural scratches.
It's coming.
I did that in when I was on Stealth. We had to do all these canopies
yeah.
for the, you know, and you, every time you have the sun there, you have all these little, the radial scratches that
yes.
happen. So
yeah,
that,
yeah.
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 Exactly.
So this is something that we would like to work together.
That's cool. That's really cool. That's yep. really cool. All right. Well, let's talk about some products. Let's do a yep. little bit more product stuff if we can. You guys made an announcement about Corona 2, right?
Yes.
Beta's happening.
It was coming for a long time.
Yeah.
But one detail which might confuse a lot of people is about the version number.
Okay.
So previously we had some alpha versions, then we had Corona 1, mm-hmm. then it was 1.1, 1.2, etc. And it went up until 1.7.
Mm-hmm.
And basically we realized that we did this versioning like, because everybody does it like this.
Mm-hmm.
So you just have to have some like 1.1 and then...
Yep.
And then sometimes 2.0, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But we realized this doesn't actually, you know, reflect the way we develop the software.
Okay.
Because we have the subscription, we don't need to worry about the licensing. We don't have to, you know, worry about putting the major version every few years or mm-hmm. not doing the major version too often or... You know, we don't have to deal with this. We just
consistently give updates as they come.
It's just when you pay, you get access to everything we do.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the way we work is that we have these cycles that somehow naturally ended up being about half a year.
Okay.
So it takes roughly half a year to make multiple big features mm-hmm. and fix several bugs and do reasonable testing.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what we do. Twice a year, we do a new version. And we started naming them 1.1, 1.2, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And we are nearing the 1.9. And the question is, what do you do after 1.9?
Did you go 1.10?
Of course, you can do 1.10. And for example, Embry had version 2.17.
Yep.
This is definitely possible, but it somehow confuses people because...
Yes.
It's for programmers, 1.10 makes sense. For users, 1.10 might not make sense.
They think it's 1.1 again sometimes.
Right.
Yep.
And also users expect the version 2 to be somehow revolutionary. Like
you
need to do at least GPU rendering or, or at
some
least
major
cloud or just yeah. something groundbreaking.
Yeah.
And because we do these half-year release cycles,
mm-hmm.
we are not able to stash enough of this to make a huge release.
Right.
We would much rather just do multiple releases and just immediately when we have something, we want to share it with users as soon as possible.
Right.
So we were not solving this and just doing the 1.something.
Mm-hmm.
And then we are nearing the 1.9 point and... Mm-hmm. The question is what to do, and we decided, okay, so let's just do the version 2, and then there will be version 3, 4, 5,
mm-hmm.
like basically like the internet browsers do it.
Okay.
And I think more and more open source software is going in this direction.
Where they just have it have a full number every time.
Yeah, it's just simpler, and the important thing is that it reflects the way the software is developed.
Right.
So there will be some confusion. So
sure.
So, and we decided, okay, we will deal with the confusion right now.
Right.
And just have it solved in the future.
Well, the way I think about it is like, I use like Adobe products, right? So I have the Adobe mm-hmm. Creative Cloud, and that's the similar idea. I'm paying for it every month, right? And then mm-hmm. I get any updates out there. But I don't think it's like, what version of, I have no idea what version of Photoshop it is. I don't care anymore, right? Because it just happens all the time. And it's like Adobe Cloud, it says 2018 here. It's like, okay, so, well, it happens to be at the same date that it is today right now. But it doesn't really mean anything. It's not like
We also didn't want to do the year versioning because that would mean that we somehow have to conform to the actual year with the versioning. And it's like sometimes you make three updates, sometimes you make two.
Right.
And we don't want to wait for the right year to release the software.
Right. Yeah. That makes sense. You guys offering a subscription, and like you said, you make it available all the time to whatever it is. That's really
so the important thing is that even though the next version is named Corona 2, mm-hmm. it doesn't mean like it's a new software.
Right.
It's like it would be named 1.8.
Right.
And we just want to continue what we are doing, and we will continue doing it with Corona 2, then 3, 4, 5, etc.
Okay, well, what small things then or medium things are you offering in Corona 2 that's coming out?
Of course, we have like huge things, but we had huge things before in the
sure.
in the before between 1.3 and 1.4. There were so many huge things.
Yep.
So the biggest thing by very large margin in the version 2 is support for the heterogeneous media.
What does that mean?
I would let Jaroslav answer the question because he's expert in this field, actually, and he oversaw the initial design. And
okay.
Well, what it means is volumetrics, right?
Volumetrics, okay.
Yeah. Volumetrics. And so part of it was redesigning part of the internals of the shading loop, of the tracing loop,
mm-hmm.
because that's... I wrote the initial implementation of the volumetrics that we had there, which could only be homogeneous. So you wouldn't be able to do any smoke or anything. You would just have, you know, an object filled with a volume or something like that.
Right.
And everything was really optimized for that case, but unfortunately the code wouldn't generalize to this case of, you know, explosions and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So fortunately, we have Martin Schick. He's a almost graduated PhD. He has been working on light transport for the last 5 years straight.
Mm-hmm.
He's a super smart guy. He sat down, he rewrote the whole thing. So he changed the support. He included the support for volumetrics in the core. And I thought this was going to be it, but it turned out that this is where the whole work actually started, because after that he had to implement the support for all the different solvers,
okay,
all the different data formats and so on and so forth.
Right. So OpenVDB and this and this.
Yes. And in fact, this turned out to be, in terms of the time spent on the implementation, this turned out to be at least 4 or 5 times as much time as actually doing the support in the render.
Yeah, itself. It's always the case, right?
It was actually the most costly feature we did so far.
Really?
Maybe on par with distributed rendering.
Wow.
But really, it was the case of just one developer spending the entire release cycle doing just one thing.
Wow.
And previously that happened, after that, we started with the 1.0.
Mm-hmm.
This happened only with distributed rendering.
Wow. And what is your distributed rendering now? Because you're distributing, you guys are a progressive renderer, right? You guys don't do buckets, right? So distributed rendering on progressive is actually a pretty hard problem to solve.
It's a lot of data that you need to send around.
That's the one I'm getting at.
Yeah.
So I'd like to know, like, what is the magic to make that happen? How do you figure out the optimal way of sharing that data?
Well, with DR, it's difficult.
Yeah.
I don't really have, some technical answer to this.
Okay.
Because it's just a matter of trying what works and what doesn't work.
Right.
And just trying to think in the concept of, usually people have this amount of memory on their render nodes and this amount of bandwidth on the network, so it makes sense to send chunks at least this big, or we need to split it more or split it less.
Mm-hmm.
And I did it in the beginning, and then we reworked it somewhere last year.
Okay.
That was the huge, huge time, which when we did some essential stuff like sending missing assets and better error reporting and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And right now it works.
Okay.
It's not as finished as we would like it to be, but you know, then what is?
Yeah, exactly.
But of course, the big question right now and super exciting stuff is the V-Ray Cloud.
Yeah.
Everybody right now saw the keynote with the with the 8,000 something.
I think it was 7,000 cores.
Yeah, but it could be 8,000. You know,
it could be
anything. That's the point. So this was actually super interesting and impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we wanted to do it before.
Yep.
But now we want to do it even more.
Yeah. Yeah. I think thinking about massive scalability is a really interesting problem, especially if things scale very linearly. And that's the thing that I think is the interesting problem to solve, especially on the progressive side of things, which, you know, you guys have some smart people that are, looks like you've gotten some of that solved. And like you said, you want to get it better, but.
I think even with the progressive engine, you can achieve some decent, actually good scalability, but
it's going to be
a complicated algorithm. You have to just give up having one centralized hub where all the data is being sent,
right,
and actually write a truly distributed system so that actually different nodes in the system can actually put all these images together. Because if you rely on sending the data to one hub, this is never going to scale. This is never going to
like
work.
Like BitTorrent.
Yes. You really want to do a BitTorrent on these images.
Well, yes, you can actually use it, because BitTorrent is actually a library that you can use it. And it solves exactly this problem, like distributing huge amount of data
and sharing
in some arbitrary network.
Yeah.
So the idea to actually use BitTorrent for just sending and gathering the data from all the older render slave.
Yeah.
That's another thing we want to try for a long time.
Yeah.
It's like when we have finally time.
Yeah.
I like this idea. That's good. Well, I think this is fascinating. I really love the fact that you guys are thinking about things and sharing these ideas and going back and forth. And obviously, you have a big, you know, group of people. You seem very interested in R&D. You love the academic world, it seems like.
Oh, yeah. This is my world.
Yeah, it's your world. But I like the fact that you're not just an academic world. You're actually applying that academic knowledge back to some practical products that can benefit from it, right?
Yes.
So that's a big thing. Now, I know we usually start with the origin stories at the beginning of the podcast, but I got distracted by geek talk. But let's talk about that. When you first started, I mean, I remember you said you were in university and you were basically like wrote a clone to V-Ray just to see if you could do it, right, in sort of ways. But then how did you get involved into the idea, and how did you guys connect?
Ondra came up. I knew. Okay, so where do I start? I'm just going back in time and deciding from where I'm gonna take it. Okay, but
I was born in 1989.
I was born in 1976, 10 years before that.
1989. That's when I graduated
87,
high school.
87.
Okay, 89 is when I graduated high school. So you were two.
Right. No. Okay. So I've been aware of Ondra's work since the very beginning, because the guy that actually got him into writing it was my former student from the university where Ondra was studying. Mm-hmm. And he Tomáš Davidovič, and he was the person who suggested to Ondra to start working on a render. And during that time, he kind of hooked us up together, and we exchanged a few emails. I was given some suggestions, and then there was no communication for quite a long period of time. Mm-hmm. And then
you told me that my diploma thesis will not work. Then I said, no, it will work. Then it didn't work.
Really? I don't know.
Yes. So you told me it wasn't going to work. You said it will work.
It wasn't like it wouldn't work. It was like it will be irrelevant. Irrelevant, which
irrelevant, yeah.
In the end.
Okay.
Well, irrelevant.
I mean, the research part of it was irrelevant.
Right.
It made some nice images, but that was it.
Okay. So I guess Ondra was going to work on something that I've already tried before and I knew it wasn't going to work. So after that I got back from Cornell and I started the research group at the Charles University, and Ondra decided to sign up for a PhD with me as an advisor. Mm-hmm. And we started working together on various topics that in retrospect, I have to say, well, I wouldn't choose them again today, but we did actually quite some good work in terms of academic research. Mm-hmm. But Ondra, just during all this time, whenever he could have any cycle of time, he would just put it into Corona. Okay, so it was already then, it was his kind of baby, and he really wanted to work on it. And so
I was a bad student.
Yeah, so at at the beginning, we tried to kind of like distribute the time. Then it was a bit progressive where I was kind of like yielding to Ondra's push on Corona. So
but you were his academic advisor, right?
Yeah, I was his academic advisor. Okay. And I saw that he really wants to do it. So then we said, okay, so the next paper, and that was actually a paper that I mentioned in the presentation today, where we worked on the kind of like the working out the initial ideas on path guiding and using machine learning for that. Mm-hmm. So we made a decision that this was going to be implemented into what was Corona then. Mm-hmm. In retrospect, it was a terrible decision because we actually implemented the whole thing in two different rendering engines, in Mitsuba and in Corona, and then we had really hard times actually putting it together. And then Corona was closed source, so when someone wanted to work on it, he couldn't, and so on and so forth. Anyway, so this was one experience during which Corona got VCM implementation that's been there since then and so on. But after this experience, at some point, Ondra made a decision to focus just on Corona. And I told him, okay, it's okay. Work on Corona as your PhD. Mm-hmm. Just take the time. You don't have to work on any papers. Just sit in that office and work on Corona. It's okay.
Okay.
And at the time, it still wasn't the idea of commercialization, but I don't know. I kind of like over time I started seeing the project more and more and seeing the potential, and then when Ondra started looking into or talking about the commercialization, I realized that I would like to share that experience. So I have to acknowledge Ondra fully for coming up with the idea of commercializing this thing. Mm-hmm. And I kind of like joined in. Okay. Mm-hmm. So and I think it in the end it worked out quite fine because mm-hmm. This connection to the university was, I think, quite beneficial.
Yeah.
In terms of being able to get people that actually had the experience that we needed, put them on board,
right,
and work together. Yeah.
Yeah. So you guys have a great pool of developers that have ideas that you can implement into the system, right?
Yeah. Yes, the pool is drying out. But
yeah.
Yes, it is true. No. We have seriously, we have been very, very extremely lucky with the people we got, and many of them are coming from, I mean, essentially all the crew is coming either from the Technical University or from Charles University, where I am right now.
Right.
And, these people are really excellent. You know, it's right. Thanks to them that Corona is what it is.
So. That's awesome. That's really great. So Corona has now obviously gone through several changes. It started off as an academic research kind of idea, but you it was more like a, sounds like an obsession and a hobby at the same time. Then,
right? I can confirm.
Yeah.
And that's then, kind of a cut. I can confirm.
Okay. But, and then after you obviously guys like, yay, maybe people will buy this, you know, and then obviously all the things about, you know, joining in Chaos Group, et cetera, has happened. And now you obviously, we talked a little bit about what's happened over the last year and how you're like, oh crap, you know, how do we put this stuff together and thinking about ideas. That's been really cool. Now, you mentioned AI as something that you want to be able to think more about in terms of the ability of what it can contribute to rendering.
Yeah.
Do you feel that that's going to be really the next big thing that's going to change rendering?
It's already changing rendering.
It is already changing.
It's already changing rendering in many ways, okay? And I've been, recently I've been doing my career review, you know? And
career review?
Career review. Like,
as an introspectively?
As in, yeah, as a retrospective.
Retrospective, okay. Yes. But internal.
Yes. And I've been looking at ideas that I had over time and what actually came out of them. And this idea of... coming across machine learning and realizing that this is an extremely important area for rendering. This is something I remember having this idea back in 2012, going through the videos and actually learning about all of this and just this moment when you realize just how closely related these two things are and then realizing that no one actually has realized it before. And the way we started looking into this problem of path guiding, where we actually applied some elements of machine learning or statistical learning. But I, at the time, I think I underestimated or didn't realize fully the potential of deep learning, and for example, for denoising.
Mm-hmm.
And I do remember actually talking to a friend of mine, Eric Risser, who's he's the founder and the CEO of Artomatics. They do texture synthesis for content generation for games.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, he told me, I told him about this great idea of, okay, how I'm going to learn what's going on in the scenes and I'm going to use it to make the sampling more intelligent, and everything is going to be super fast and super linear convergence and everything. And he was like, why do we even bother with any sampling? Why don't you just learn how the scene should look like? And I thought he was crazy. You know, I thought,
yeah, but then look what's happening.
Yeah. Yeah. I know.
Yeah.
I know. And so yeah, in a way this guy was really visionary, and I have to admit that I didn't see it then. Okay, so I was still very much in this world of Monte Carlo sampling and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where the impact, there is a big impact of learning in you know, using it for adaptive sampling.
Mm-hmm.
But also this higher level idea of actually learning how the scene should look like without really having to run any simulation underneath that. That is, I think, going to make a big change. You know, we will no longer talk about whether it's biased or non-biased, because no one really cares. People care about whether it looks good or not, right, realistic. And I think you can learn how, you know, a bunch of objects configured in some geometry configuration.
Do you guys really feel that, like, for example, if you take that to the extreme, right, from like the user's perspective, what you do and what you get, right? Do you think you're going to get to the point where I can write down text that describes the room that I want to render and it just renders it for you, visually speaking? Like, oh, he described a bathroom here, this there, and you can just talk to the computer or write in the computer.
Yeah, I think
and it's going to just make it for you.
Yeah, I think you can you can break it down into things like you do today. One is modeling the scene, and mm-hmm. second is generating that final image.
Mm-hmm.
And my answer to both of these steps would be yes and yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think you can definitely do it. I mean, you can already there are already some initial attempts at that today. Yeah. You can definitely, especially when you start focusing on a type of an environment, if you say that it's an interior, mm-hmm. and then you start describing the interior, you can already do some modeling essentially based on nothing. You can actually generate a full interior that looks quite plausible today, and people have already started looking into style of 3D objects. Okay, so what defines a style of a piece of a furniture? How can I computationally see, okay, if this kind of furniture, this piece of furniture goes well with that kind of furniture, and so on? So I think we will definitely be able to do this. Yeah.
What do you think, Andre? What do you think the future of rendering is?
I think this will be done.
Yeah.
That's like, we can't, there's no way this won't be done.
Right.
It's just one question is, you know, will it actually be usable, or will it be like a toy? Yes. Like
right now, it's, for example, a really good tech demo in some ways, right? Yeah. There's a lot of one of my people I've interviewed before is Rudy Rucker, and he's like a computer science and math guy, and we talk about some of the stuff that people do is like, oh, look, you know, it makes a picture and it makes you look like whatever, you know, like a painting, and it has all these different styles. That is, he says, that's more of a what does the word he uses, like a snake oil. It's like it's showing you something, but it's not really the power of what it is.
It's not just that, just like whether it's practically, whether it really works, or it's just the demo. It's for example, I remember sometimes in 90s I was reading like how you will shop in the future on the internet, mm-hmm. and it was basically the idea that you would put on some virtual reality glasses, uh-huh. and you would walk through virtual supermarket and you would pick the virtual goods from the shelves,
right.
and they would deliver it to your house by some rocket or something. And now when you think about this, when you really go shopping, you don't want to, you know, look at the shelves, you want to search.
Right.
That's way better.
Yes.
But the idea was, you know, it looks cool, so we'll do it like this.
Right, because the only way people knew how to shop was to go in shelves. Right. And so how are you going to go on the computer?
Well, in a way, you want to search, but they want you to browse. Because when you browse, you buy things that you didn't want to buy.
Well, let's not go into the venue of how to extract money from this technology.
However, but by you're not just browsing, as you're also doing ads, right? So you have little ads on the side. I still remember, I don't know how it happened, a friend of mine, we were having a conversation, and this never happens. No one ever does this, but this, for some reason, this guy did it. He's like, you were browsing, and he was right on the side. He saw an ad on his browser that had the same yellow tennis shoes that Bruce Lee wore in Enter the Dragon. And so he said, oh, wow, look at those shoes. And he clicked on the ad, bought them right away, and went back to the conversation. He's like, this never happens. Yeah. But somehow it happens enough that it's relevant ad is there. And that's also, by the way, the guy who made that stuff happen was mm-hmm. one of the guys who won a SciTech Award for important sampling, right?
Yes.
So it's like he knows specifically that the guy – there's going to be an interest from this person because, you know, there's a lot of Bruce Lee films. Or
yes, true.
But yeah, okay.
So what I mean is that this will definitely be doable, uh-huh. like in technical way.
Yeah.
Question is, you know, you will type something or probably pick something. I guess, you know, visual input would be better, like mm-hmm. picking from variants. It's just the question is, will it really produce the output you want?
Yeah.
And second thing is, will it really solve a problem that's like, maybe thing is, will it be done by artists, or will it be done directly by somebody who wants to furnish the apartment?
Right. Yes.
So I'm sure the technical thing will be done. It's just a question, will it be just some cool demo like, or will it be what the industry does, or will it be what everybody does?
I think like once the technology is available, you can really shape it in many different ways for many different uses, and it's gonna be packaged very differently, you know, if it's for an artist or for someone who just wants to try out designs for their home.
Right.
Yeah, so it's gonna be very different. But you know, as I remember last night working on the slides, and then every time I pasted an image onto my slides, I got a design suggestion. Okay, so I was thinking, okay, well, this is exactly what we want to do in 3D, but the way it's done here in this PowerPoint, it's driving me crazy, because what it does is that it all these design suggestions, first of all, they have nothing to do with the style of my slides. Second of all, they eat half of my screen space.
Yep.
And third of all, they appear right under my mouse. So when I click next time, instead of clicking on what I wanted to click in the first place, some element on the slide, I end up clicking on the design suggestion because right. It appeared in the meantime. And I was like, hey, so this is, in a way, it's a cool technology, and again, executed in a horrible way.
Right.
In a way, it's like a warning for you, like, okay, if I ever do this in 3D, I will definitely have to make sure that it just doesn't stand in the way of being able to produce something that you really want to.
So no Clippy for 3D. Right? I get it. But let's if you guys are talking about machine learning, obviously there's something else that I want to talk about, and we're going a little over. Are you guys okay with time?
Yeah, I still have half hour.
Okay,
yeah,
perfect.
Sure.
So just a quick thing. A lot of talk's been going into machine learning in general and deep learning and all those things. And one of the biggest hardware influencers in this area has been GPU rendering or GPU technology, right? Because of the way that the deep learning happens, it takes advantage of massively parallel processing. Do you feel that now, I mean, that you would be taking advantage of GPU technology, not necessarily for ray tracing, but for learning to implement some of the features and things that you're looking at?
Okay, so the learning that's a longer term research, and the answer is absolutely yes, because mm-hmm. if you want to train a network or if you want to run it, I mean, you used a prepackaged library, right? I mean, you use one
oh,
of the
for the denoiser.
For any sort of learning that you want to do.
Okay, right? Okay.
And these libraries, they can run on CPUs, they can run on GPUs, except that on the GPUs, they're so much faster. So it probably pays off because you really, you know, when you're doing your research, you try 10 different parameter settings or mm-hmm. different ideas, and no one really understands how these networks work. So all you can do is just try out until you find the solution.
Right.
So you definitely want to be able to have this cycle real quick. So whatever hardware is going to help you to have a quick turnaround on testing ideas is the one that we're going to use. When it comes to GPUs in rendering, I would hand it over to Ondra to answer that question.
Yeah, what are your thoughts, Ondra?
Mm-hmm. So the good thing about you know, being in contact with the V-Ray team,
yeah,
is that now we have the, you know, real experience with
right.
GPU rendering, not the stuff you read on the internet, which is usually biased or really uninformed.
Right.
And with this in mind, the answer is it depends.
Right.
It's you know, it's not a silver bullet. It's not like it doesn't do the work for you.
Mm-hmm.
And it obviously has some merit. So.
And it's also like one of the problems that you have to rewrite everything.
Right.
Or at
that's,
least the core.
That's not the biggest problem. The biggest problem is that you rewrite everything and then you end up not supporting something you did support in the beginning.
Right.
So I was recently thinking, and I think there is not a single renderer so far that made successful switch from CPU to GPU. Like most of them started completely as a complete new renderer.
Okay. And
even V-Ray GPU is...
Is a new render.
Is in reality a different renderer.
Right.
So if we would do it, we would be the first ones.
Right.
And what we want to do is basically to dip our toes in the water.
Okay.
Which is to do some post-processing, denoising,
just try how it works out on smaller stuff.
Okay.
And at the same time, we will definitely look at the new ray tracing technology.
Right.
And we will just see if it goes somewhere.
Okay.
But just talking about switching the whole Corona onto GPU, it's basically by definition, it's an impossible task.
Right.
And we would have to do some compromises. Okay. And so there's no decision to do it right now. We would have to pick some strategy how to deal with these things, like the amount of time and the fact that we would lose support of some of the features that we do.
Yeah, that's a problem. It's a problem to think about. I mean, obviously we've gotten our GPU renderer right now is much very, very mature. But the idea of, you know, one thing that's not possible and new in one or different than this, it's hard to do. It's hard to do for sure. Well, this has been great. I really appreciate your time. Is there anything else you guys want to mention before it goes? Is there some other things that you think would be important for our users to know about?
I would like to say that Total Chaos is really great.
Yeah.
And that people should come over next year. And we will definitely run it in Prague at some point. I don't know if next year, but if not next year, it's going to be the year after.
Yeah.
It's been great. And thanks a lot for having us.
Yeah. No, it's been really cool. And it's really awesome that we can all be together and talk about this and the successes that we have. And have you guys on stage at the same time as us and just be all in there. And I think that the guys at Chaos Group did an amazing job putting this together. Now, I don't want to sound, I'm not sounding negative, but this is well beyond what I expected. Like, I thought it was going to be good, but this is like, holy crap good. And the attendance is huge. There's a lot of people. Every room is full.
Agree.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Thanks so much, guys. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.